As Lynn ate the second of the two candy bars she'd bought very ceremoniously at nightfall, as they rolled along the Queen Elizabeth Way with Lake Ontario to their right, and sang a short and beautiful little song in her native language as the sun dipped below the western horizon and vanished off somewhere beyond Hamilton. They arrived at the limits of Toronto at 7:15, and, as the bus approached the city, Moose announced, "Okay, now where are we headed?" Devlin slid over to the edge of the seat nearest the driver's station and rummaged in the pockets of his trench coat. He had been looking a little peaked at customs, possibly a touch of motion sickness, but had settled nicely after they were on their way again, and now looked positively relaxed as he pulled a sheaf of papers out of his pocket and spread them open. "Right," he said. "We're playing a place called Sneaky D's, which is at a place called Batherson's College." "And that is..." Moose wondered. "Well, I'm not entirely sure," Devlin said, "so that's why I brought this map." The second sheet of paper proved to be, indeed, a map, albeit a rather grainy one, all in shades of gray, and not showing very much detail. "Where?" Moose asked levelly as he surveyed this cartographical wonder by the light of his driver's lamp. "Did you get this map?" "It's the inset map from the Rand McNally Road Atlas page for Ontario," Devlin replied. "Blown up to 250%. Not a bad trick, eh, what?" "Why," Moose asked levelly, "didn't you bring the whole atlas?"
"Well, I couldn't, could I? It's not mine, is it? Belongs to the school library. Reference only, don't you know? Not to be removed."
"And what year," Moose asked levelly, "is the library's atlas from?" Devlin considered this for a moment.
2384, I think.
"That," Moose remarked levelly, "was before any of us was born." He raised his voice slightly. "Edward?"
"Edward is awake!"
cried Edward, jolting upright and causing a minor cascade of coiled patch cables. "Can you find out where Batherson's College is in Toronto?" A pause.
"No. Edward didn't pay for the Canada add-on pack to the navigation software."
"Well, steal it, then," Amanda snapped. "Surely your larcenous soul can support such a gesture in a time of need."
"You don't have to yell at Edward," Edward pouted. "Anyway, there is no Batherson's College in Toronto."
"What?"
cried Amanda.
"Edward said you didn't have to yell."
"You half-witted, inbred toad of an Earthman," Amanda barked across the aisle.
"It's not my fault," Devlin protested. "That's what the chap said on the phone."
His accent suddenly and dramatically mutated into a middle Ontario drawl with a hint of a whine in it.
"You can't miss us, eh? We're right on Batherson's College. Big neon sign and all."
Maybe it's a department of the university, Caitlin mused. "Okay," said Moose, still equable. "I'll go up there and look around." They cruised around the university district for half an hour and found nothing. Moose, still calm, started expanding their search grid. The others crowded into the front seats, all straining their eyes.
"Hey," said Utina after another half hour. "I think I've figured something out about the way they name the roads here."
"Please," Moose said in a desperate tone, "share."
"It looks like all the north-south streets are something Avenue," Utina told him, "and all the east-west streets are something Road. If that's true, we can at least keep track of what direction we're going in."
"Say, that's clever," said Moose. "I'm too busy with this traffic to be reading street signs. What's the next street?" Utina's heart sank. "Avenue, Road," she said. "Great," Moose replied. "Must run at an angle," he added with a grin.
"Oh, gosh," Azalin murmured a few fruitless minutes later. "When are we supposed to go on?"
"Not until 10, said Devlin. "We've plenty of time yet."
You've jinxed these proceedings enough, Earthman, said Amanda. Keep silent. At 9:15, Azalyn moaned. We're going to die in this bus. Cursed to search for Batherson's College for the rest of eternity. We'll starve. I'll never fall in love. Have a donut, Amanda said dryly. We've plenty. Azalyn did, and felt better. At 9:40, they still hadn't found what they were looking for. Even Moose was starting to look a little despairing, and Amanda and Azalyn had both returned to the rear seats, one to sulk, the other to fret. Okay, said Moose tiredly. We're on College, anyway. What's the next cross street? Utina peered at the approaching sign. It was hard to read. The glare from a bar or restaurant or something on the corner was washing the letters out. Finally, she was able to make it out. Bathurst, she said. Then, and only then, did she spare a glance at the business whose neon lighting had made the street sign so hard to read. And that's Sneaky D's. Moose swung the van dexterously to the side of the street, yanked on the handbrake, and gave a tremendous gushing sigh as cheers erupted behind him, and Utina, as though she had had something to do with this remarkable piece of luck just by reporting it, was slapped on the back, hugged by Azalyn, licked by Ayn, and told repeatedly that she rocked. Okay, said Moose. We're here, at Bathurst and College, he said, eyeing Devlin irritably. And we've got 15 minutes to set up. Let's get busy. Engineer Edward is on the case, said Edward, regarding the tangle of patch cables with a critical eye. The show, though set up was a bit, well, a lot, rushed, went very well, Utina thought. She was no musician, and so couldn't tell how satisfied the band members ought to be, but hearing it, she figured it sounded all right. Despite the long drive, the members of the band were high energy once they got on stage, all their cares and worries forgotten. It was a good room, too, comfortable, if smoky, and the crowd was far and away better than the surly mob at Sir Morgan's Dive. Kate stood front and center, in gray jeans and an Ontario Science Center t-shirt, under an unbuttoned blue-and-white striped flannel shirt, behind her rack of keyboards, microphone, and other assorted gear. Azalyn, her vivid black pouchling stripes temp-dyed back into her gray hair, flanked Kate to the right with her favorite guitar slung ready. She and Amanda made an interesting contrast on either side of Kate, both with unusually colored skin, Azalyn's glowing coppery in the stage lights, Amanda's robin's egg blue. One short and slim, the other tall and athletic. One in WPI athletic department tank top and shorts, the other in black leather cycling pants and vest. Utina wondered, not for the first time, what the intricate tattoo that covered most of the Gamelon's right arm in a circuit-like mesh of black arcs and lines meant. She'd first noticed it during one of their pickup basketball games, but never asked. Behind the three women, Moose McEachern loomed, a great black presence. Black skin, black turtleneck, black jeans, great shiny black bass guitar. Moose's new axe was, indeed, bitchin' unto the supreme degree. A little to his left, still swathed in his bulky gray coat, Devlin Carter sat at the drum trap, rising sun hachimaki around his forehead, smiling. "Ladies and gentlemen," Moose boomed, silencing the chatter of the waiting crowd. "Thank you for coming. I am the Honorable J. Maurice McEachern, and this," he gestured around him, "is the Art of Noise." Without anything further from him, the band swung into a pounding rock intro line, Devlin's bass drum slamming down each individual beat as Amanda layered a rhythm line with Azalyn's solo guitar, and Moose's axe throbbed along behind them. They held this for 16 bars, then burst into a swift and catchy hook that drew the audience right into the performance, even before Caitlin lifted her face to the microphone and sang. So I think I got it all in place, yeah. Change. Devlin's drumming thrust them into the chorus, brighter and stronger than the main verse. They returned to the original theme, and by now they had much of the room on its feet, dancing in a surging mass. Utina, who was standing off to the side in a mostly empty corner, behind a table with a pile of AON shirts and data crystals of their last record, smiled and danced a little with herself. She'd been listening to them rehearse this track for a new show opener all term, and knew the words as well as Cade. After the second chorus, they didn't pause, but leaped directly into a bridge, much of the bass line falling away to reveal Kate's hammering synth line as she leaned forward a little more and belted out a tight harmony with Azalin and Amanda. As she sang the last line, Kate gave a little grin and looked directly at Utina, and as they made an instant's eye contact, Utina felt herself smiling back. It was as though Kate had sung the bridge expressly for her. That usually happened when they did this song. Not, Utina had figured out fairly early on, because Kate couldn't explain the way her roommate made her feel, but because she somehow understood that Utina felt that way about somebody else. Not for the first time, Utina wondered if she shouldn't tell Kate the story, but this was not the right time to be making that sort of decision, and she lost herself in the music again after considering it for only a moment. The band hovered on the peak of that line for an instant, then fell back to the original hook, this time overlaid by a soaring guitar solo from Azalin, whose golden alien eyes glittered interestingly in the stage lighting. When she'd finished, they fell effortlessly back into the chorus again, repeated it with Kate's usual impromptu lyrical digressions, and ended abruptly, with the last bright wail of Azalin's guitar coming after everyone else had stopped, like an exclamation point at the end of the 4-minute sentence. Applause and cheering burst from the assembled crowd, and Utina started selling gear. For 2.5 hours, the Art of Noise alternately rocked, rolled, and moved the house, and by the end of the first hour, Utina had nothing to do but stand there and enjoy the show, from behind her empty table. Every 10 minutes or so, someone would come up and cleverly offer to buy the last T-shirt, but as she was wearing it under her unbuttoned jacket, Utina patiently informed each and every one of them that they couldn't afford it, and 9 out of 10 went away without further prodding. The 10th found himself persuaded to go elsewhere by the bartender before Utina had to do anything about him herself. As the night went on, Utina noticed that Caitlin didn't speak a word. She either sang or stood with a silent smile while Moose spoke for her, introducing the rest of the band in turns, making it plain that he was merely the speaker and she the guiding light of the group, in terms so flowery and affectionate that she gave him an exasperated look and, at one point, threw a dust cloth at him. Azalin told a couple of jokes in between numbers. At one point, the rest of the band took a break, and Kate played an instrumental version of the ancient Buggles classic Video Killed the Radio Star on her keyboard array. Devlin took the microphone for a comical cover of an equally ancient song about single record B-sides. The A-side has the hit. The B-side ain't got anything. Amanda said nothing, merely stood there looking cool and intimidating. They finished the show with a sweet little song about old friends meeting unexpectedly in an unfamiliar place, did one encore, in which Caitlin performed an old standard of her childhood hero Martin Rose's band, the Clay Pigeons, Programmer, and the show was over. While Usna folded up the empty boxes which had held the shirts and crystals, she smiled to herself as she overheard various patrons, filing past her table on their way out, talking about how much they had enjoyed the show.
"That was a hell of a show," said the bartender, a bushy-eyebrowed fellow who rejoiced in the name Dimitrios Makinikos Arbuthnot.
"You want a Coke? On the house."
"Sure," said Utina as she stuffed the folded boxes into the trash barrel behind the bar. "Then I have to go help my friends pack up. Thanks for handling that one guy, by the way. He would have tarnished the evening a little if I'd had to hurt him."
Dimitrios nodded, smiling sagely, as he popped the top off a bottle of Coke and handed it to her.
"You do sort of invite it," he pointed out, "wearing the last shirt like that. This is a college crowd. They're not very original."
Utina laughed and drank.
"Didn't think of it," she admitted. "I just wanted to show I was with the band." "Hell of a band," Dimitrios mused, shaking his head. "Shame you have to come from so far away. I wish I could have you in here every week. Do I pay you, or..."
"No, Devlin, the drummer, he's the manager. He'll be out in a bit. He likes to make sure he gets his drums packed before he does anything else. He's kind of picky about them."
Dimitrios nodded again. "The good ones are," he said.
Utina drained her Coke, thanked the bartender for it, and headed backstage to help out with the packing up. The seven of them, and Ayn, rode the post-performance high out into the streets of Toronto at 2, and promptly found themselves in Chinatown, eating a late and sumptuous dinner at a small, tackily decorated but friendly restaurant called Happy Seven. They talked animatedly about the things they'd liked, things they thought they could have done better, and a couple of moments, which Utina had missed entirely, where they seemed to think they almost fell completely apart. Utina told them how pleased Mr. Arbuthnot had been with their performance, and Devlin seconded that, gleefully pointing out that he'd given them an extra 10%, as he put it, for chops.
"Ooh, we have to come back here," Esalen said with sensual delight after sliding a wad of lo mein noodles languorously down her gullet. "The food is so good."
"Canada," said Caitlin, "is a magical and exotic place where everything is better. Utina, who had almost become inured to the meal plan food at WPI, had to agree from the depths of her Szechuan chicken.
"You guys," said Moose, "I think we might have a problem."
They blinked at him, conversation stilled.
"What?"
Azalin finally asked.
Moose blinked at them, yawned, and said, "I don't think I'm going to be able to get us home."
"Right, well, we got an extra 10%, said Devlin. "We'll stay somewhere and drive back tomorrow, what?"
"Sure," said Azalin. "It shouldn't be hard to find a Motel 6 or something." Having narrowly avoided getting the van towed from in front of Happy Seven, the smirk and salute from the cruising tow truck operator who passed by just as they emerged from the restaurant was worth the near panic attack, it took them until 4, by which time they were almost to Mississauga, before they finally caught sight of a Motel 6 sign jutting up above the great sound-deadening highway wall that lined the QEW west of the city. By now they were all barely conscious, the postprandial hibernation effect having shorn the group of their collective adrenaline high and reminded them that, except for uncomfortable and unrestful naps on the bus, they'd been up since 8 the previous morning. Edward and Ayn were sprawled among the equipment, dead to the world. Utina had curled up in the seat behind Moose, Kate and Azalin in the one behind her, as Devlin sat at the corner and provided sleepy moral support for Moose, and Amanda hunched next to him, annoyed by the hideously poor planning that had gone into every stage of this adventure so far. Finally, though, they found one, a single-story affair in the motor court style, each room having its own exterior door. For some reason, about which Moose was not about to complain, the parking spaces were unusually wide, wide enough that AON-1 only took up one. Moose parked the van, climbed wearily out, and he and Devlin went inside the office. "Good evening, sir," said the man at the desk. "How may I help you?" Moose looked at him for a few moments, the requisite response working its way slowly through the barely turning gears in his head, and then rumbled like a tape playback on too low a speed.
We need a room.
Yes, well, there are a few available. How many of you are there? Moose blinked, looked at Devlin, then at himself, then at the desk man, and replied,
Two.
I'm afraid we only have rooms with a single queen bed available.
Whatever, Moose said.
And how will you be paying?
Cash,
Moose replied flatly, nudging Devlin, who paid. No one, not even Amanda, was awake enough to complain that there was only one room and only one bed. They dragged themselves sleepily from the van and divided the available space without discussion. Edward and Ayn could not be awakened and remained in the van, now curled into a contented ball of hacker and fur among the patch cables. Moose occupied most of the floor. Devlin rolled himself into a deceptively small package and spread his coat around him in the one small, threadbare armchair. Everyone else found a place on the bed, queen, one, non-smoking, and consciousness left them before they had a chance to really think about arranging anything in any particular way. For the first time since coming to Earth, Utina dreamed of nothing in particular. Utina awoke slowly and fuzzily, as usual, but perhaps more so this time because of the strange surroundings. The room was dim and quiet, and she was so comfortable and relaxed that she didn't want to move just to see where she was. She'd rather just stay here, warm and content, on her side, her legs linked like the fingers of clasped hands with those of the softly snoring person in her arms, the pleasantly solid weight against her chest moving gently with her breathing, and what? Her eyes popped open, but she managed not to start too violently and muffled her gasp as she came fully awake and looked down at herself. She was still dressed, a relief, as was the one she held, but she was definitely holding someone. Caitlin was curled in against her, one slack fist drawn up to the side of her own face, the other side pressed snugly to the black cloth of Utina's jacket. Utina opened her mouth to say something, then stopped herself. What did it hurt? They obviously hadn't done anything. She wasn't sure if Kate was even into that kind of thing. And, the still aching wound in her heart notwithstanding, Utina herself generally wasn't. They just moved together in their sleep to take comfort in each other. Surely they were good enough friends by now for that not to need awkwardness on waking. And besides, Kate was so calm, so deeply asleep, with a look of such contentment on her face. What did it hurt? She made herself relax, then raised her head to have a look around. Amanda Dessler was sprawled on her back, taking up most of the bed, probably a factor in Kate and Utina having moved so close together, with Azalin balled up under one arm, her own arm flung across Amanda's middle. Devlin was still wedged into the armchair, in what looked like a supremely uncomfortable position, but he was fast asleep, so it couldn't have been too bad. From where she was looking, Utina wouldn't be able to see Moose without sitting up and disturbing Kate, but she could hear him breathing. Caitlin stirred, murmuring, and shifted slightly, then subsided back into sleep. Utina smiled and hugged her a little. It was good to be this close to someone again, to touch and be touched, even, especially, if there was nothing in it but friendship and warmth. She'd been standing off alone for too long. It wasn't in her nature to hold people who cared about her at such a distance. She realized suddenly that she'd let an irrational guilt over the idea of abandoning her old friends prevent her from getting too close to these. Having recognized it, she couldn't stop feeling that guilt, not completely, but she could stop letting it control her life. Maybe it was time to tell that story. The next time they were alone, even had she trusted the rest of them as much as she now felt she could trust Kate, it wasn't the kind of story for telling to groups. She sighed, aware that she was on the verge of throwing away this warm contentment and depressing herself. Kate stirred again, then slowly blinked her eyes open. She took stock of her situation silently, without seeming to find it all that surprising, and then looked up at her roommate and smiled gently.
Sorry, she murmured. I guess I got cold.
It's all right, Utrin replied softly. I don't mind.
You haven't been crying,
Kate pointed out, seeing no redness in her eyes, no tracks on her face.
No, Utrin replied. I don't mean to pry, Kate whispered, her cheeks reddening a little. But at night, I can hear you.
Utrin gave her a little squeeze. I'll tell you about it sometime soon, I promise.
Don't rush, Kate said. It's okay.
They stayed there for a while, unwilling to give up the moment and their little pool of warmth and comradeship. But finally, reluctantly, Kate disentangled herself and made her way to the bathroom. With that strange collective energy that seems to pervade morning gatherings once one has risen, the rest of them awoke one by one. Amanda was next. She sat partway up, looked around bemusedly, and shook Azalin's shoulder gently.
Get off me, you oversexed rodent,
she said, but her voice was not at all harsh, and Utna found herself smiling at the Gamelon's tone. Amanda caught the smile, glanced up, and then actually smiled herself before giving Azalin another shake.
I'm not oversexed,
Azalin protested blurrily as she sat up and rubbed her eyes.
Your body temperature is 101. You're the warmest thing in the room.
Devlin groaned and pried himself out of the armchair, then stood in the one bare patch of floor not occupied by part of Moose and stretched. Painful-sounding cracks and pops came from his joints as he straightened himself, then worked himself this way and that, but his face was cheerful when he finished.
Ah, he said, nothing like a good night's sleep. Eh, what?
Or mornings, Moose grumbled, as the case may be.
He sat up, looked around him, and shook his head.
Oh, boy. If the manager sees us all leaving, I'm going to be in big trouble.
Back the bus up to the door, Amanda said, and he will never see us board it.
Point. Man, I wish one of us had thought to bring toothpaste.
One of us did, Amanda replied briskly, lifting her duffel bag off the floor. It was obvious to me that your plan to drive here, perform, and drive back in a single session was absurd and unworkable. I took precautions. She spread a handful of cheap new toothbrushes out on the bed.
Amanda, said Devlin as he picked one of them up, you are a marvel.
Amanda was feeling expansive enough this morning to thank him. The bathroom door opened a moment later, and Kate emerged, looking back over her shoulder with an impressed expression.
Wow, she observed. They've got the shower stall of the future in there.
The others crowded into the doorway and had to admit that she was right. The shower was a freestanding unit, a cylinder of white plastic about 4 feet in diameter. Half of its vertical surface was a pneumatically powered door which slid around to cover the other half, and the water came out of a series of slots cut into the perimeter of the top rather than from a nozzle. The computerized controls could adjust water temperature and dispense 3 different personal care products, as well as producing 7 different flow patterns. I think today's first interesting challenge is going to be towel management, observed Utrin glumly.
Not for me, said Amanda, who pulled a large bath towel from her bag.
I don't suppose you brought one of those for everyone, said Moose.
That would have required a larger bag.
True. Moose yawned as he pulled on his shoes. I'm going to go check the van.
Kate, what happened to your face? Azalin asked.
Kate looked at her, puzzled, then turned and regarded herself in the mirror behind the sink, which in that odd Motel 6 style was not actually in the bathroom. On her right cheek was a circular mark about the size of a quarter, bright red against the whiteness of her cheek. She looked at it for a moment, puzzled,
and then snickered and glanced at Utna. Utna looked blank for a second, then blinked and began to snicker herself. Azalin looked from one to the other, puzzled over the subtext, and then realized it herself and joined them.
"What?" Amanda demanded.
"It's nothing," Kate said, raising a hand to rub vigorously at her cheek. "Button face." Amanda didn't put it together until several minutes later, when, her turn coming to use the shower, Utna undid her old uniform jacket and tossed it onto the chair before entering the bathroom. An hour later, they were all washed and had clean teeth, if somewhat stale clothes. Getting out of the motel without the manager realizing what they'd done proved as easy as Amanda had suggested, and as AON-1 pulled away, Moose thanked whatever god might have been paying attention for small favors.
"Okay," he said. "Homeward ho."
"No," Edward protested. "Cannot go home yet. Edward got us tickets for the big game."
Moose frowned, not angrily, just in a "here's a new wrinkle" sort of way.
"Big game," he said.
"Hello," said Edward. "Game 7? Red Sox Raiders? 485 years is long enough?"
Moose looked startled. "You got 7 tickets to the World Series? Today?"
8,
said Edward indignantly.
"Okay, 8, Moose conceded. "My question stands."
"I shudder to think," said Amanda, "what that must have cost."
"Oh, nothing," Edward replied. "Grom Tarantella owed Ayn a favor."
"Some favor," said Azalin.
Edward shrugged. "He's not in jail."
"Who's Grom Tarantella?" Utrinan wondered.
"Owner of the Toronto Raiders," said Devlin. "It was in all the papers. He managed to make Corellia too hot for him last year."
"I remember that," Azalin said. "Picked up his whole empire and moved it to Toronto. Nobody knew how he managed to get off Corellia alive, let alone with most of his stuff." She looked curiously at Utna. "You never heard about that? Where have you been?"
Said Utna. "Hold on a second," said Caitlin. "We're going to Game 7?
"Well, it hardly seems prudent to waste the opportunity," Moose observed with a huge grin, turning the van east instead of west on the QEW. "Means we'll have to spring for another night someplace, though."
"No worries, no worries," Edward insisted. "The Raider Dome has a hotel."
"I shudder to think," began Amanda, but Edward waved it off.
"Oh."
"Anybody care about missing Monday's classes?" Devlin wondered.
"For this?" Azalin replied.
"Thought not," said Devlin.
"If we're staying another day," Kate mused, "I need to get some clean underwear."
This observation was met with wide concurrence. They had several hours to kill before the 7:05 game, having emerged from coma at around 2, and skated narrowly around having to pay for an extra day at the Motel 6, probably just because the day man was intimidated by Moose as the night man had been. Moose dropped AON-1 in the parking garage of the Raider Dome Hotel, and they walked down to the corner of Front and Yonge Streets. It was a fine, sunny, slightly cool October day, promising to get crisp as night fell, and the 8 were in fine humor as they entered the BCE Place shopping center to address their material needs. That accomplished, they had some lunch in the Marché Mouvenpick, giving Utna a chance to find out what Seleucian Cham was supposed to taste like, the answer being damn good, then hit the Hockey Hall of Fame. There they perused the capsule histories of the hundreds of greats immortalized within, read the irony-rich story of the disappearance of the Stanley Cup, missing since 2050, and watched Kate and Utna play a furious round of bubble hockey, which Caitlin lost by way of having a traitorous forward who kept scoring own goals. "Number 6, she observed grumpily, "is going to get traded to Montreal." That exhausted, with nothing else to do that wouldn't take too long, like going to the zoo or Caitlin's favorite museum on Earth, the Ontario Science Center,
They just walked around the downtown area, enjoying the city. It was clean, gleaming, and modern, but friendly. Worcester, preserved by the well-meaning Historical Society in its historic late 20th century configuration, had very little on it. With that as a basis for comparison, Utina could see why Kate was so fond of the place. On the other hand, she'd never been to New Avalon. By a combination of haphazard planning and good luck, they found themselves near Union Station at 6:30, and from there it was a short walk indeed to the Raider Dome. Toronto Raider Dome, Utina read from the large plaque standing on the concrete plaza in front of that august structure. Home of the Toronto Raiders of the Galactic League. Constructed in 2403 on the site of the original and historic Toronto Sky Dome, Earth's first sporting venue with a fully retractable roof, which opened in 1989 and was destroyed in the Great Flood of 2102. Huh. It's a funny thing about Earth, Devlin mused. Whenever we set out to build new things nowadays, we realize all our best stuff was made in the 20th century, but it got knocked down, and we want it back, so we build it again. Amanda looked up at the rather dull white shape of the Raider Dome and said, "And this was the best you could do? No wonder your planet is in such sorry shape." "You haven't seen some of the other ballparks from that era," Devlin reminded her. "Run a hollow of the Minneapolis Metrodome sometime. Tragic and terrifying, what?" "At least the Raider Dome has real grass," said Kate, who shared Devlin's title of amateur baseball historian. That's an improvement over the original." "Too true. Shall we, ladies and gentlemen? The time approaches."